Banded together from across the internet are three random lunatics watching cartoons. The podcast of doom.
There are too many cartoons, but they'll watch them all. The Penny and James can sort of hopefully funny cartoon podcast.
Hello, everyone. I'm James Irish.
I'm Pembroke W. Corgi.
And I'm Chrissy Harding.
Welcome once again to the Pemmy, Chrissy, and James kind of sort of hopefully funny cartoon podcast. And we're doomed.
Doom, 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 doom,
yes, this week, friends, we are watching Challenge of the Super Friends.
And it was a challenge.
I actually love this show, to be honest.
I have so many questions about this show. I really do. I don't ever remember it being this. Growing up.
I love it, and I hate it at the same time.
I love it, but there's so much wrong with it. You won't even get an argument with me on that. It's just one of those cases where it's just... I kind of just love how absolutely stupid it is.
It's one of those shows where you're just like, does it get better when you watch it drunk? Like, is this one of those ones?
Well, if you watch it as a drinking game, you will get drunk.
Fair. I just, watching it, I was just like, I did not drink anything watching it, for the sheer fact is I did not want to spit anything out over my computer with some of the things that happened. And I have thoughts. I just have thoughts. I have questions.
If you think this is bad, God forbid you go watch the first incarnation of this where they have Wendy and Marvin and Wonder Dog.
You know the worst part about it is I remember that too. I remember that one. I remember the one with the Wonder Twins.
Yep.
I will say this is better because I still kind of shudder a little bit. I remember one where they had Firestorm?
Yep. And the last one, they had Cyborg.
Oh, yeah. One had Cyborg.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah, we are. Go ahead.
The Super Friends, by this point, were established as being Superman, Batman, Robin, Wonder Woman, and Aquaman. Plus, for their first season, the aforementioned teen sidekicks Wendy and Marvin and their dog, Wonder Dog. They ran a single season in 1973, but following the success of Wonder Woman and the $6 Million Man in primetime on ABC, they were brought back to the airwaves in 1977 with the all-new Super Friends Hour. Slowly but surely, Hanna-Barbera was seeing what they could and could not pull off to make a superhero cartoon without attracting the ire of network censors, who were still positively gun-shy following the 60s weirdo superhero backlash.
Space Ghost!
Thank you for explaining that. Because I'm sure there are probably some people who are like, what does that mean? So thank you for explaining that, Pemmy.
Yeah, there was a lot of concern in the 1960s about violent superhero cartoons and bizarre villains and conflicted heroes like The Thing and so on and so on and so on.
And should I mention that Hanna-Barbera didn't make it, there was literally a cartoon called Super President at one point.
Yep, that's the Patty Freeling.
Yep. So I would hate to see what they would have think of TV today with some of the stuff that's on TV now.
Oh, it wouldn't happen.
I would just want to take them, put them in front of what we have on TV now, and just watch their head explode.
So having dipped their toes back into the superhero kiddie pool with the first Super Friends, The all-new Super Friends Hour produced more competent teen sidekicks in the Wonder Twins, featured guest heroes from other DC Comics properties, and a few totally new characters for ethnic diversity reasons. And I don't say that as if to say, oh, they're just trying to be this or that or anything else. That was the stated reason. And slowly but surely, they began using villains from the comics, namely an olive brown colored Black Manta and Gentleman Ghost of all characters.
Okay.
As an aside, since we are covering the iteration of the series following the all-new Super Friends Hour, when we do circle back to that show, we should probably cover the guest heroes who did not make the transition to today's topic, namely the Atom and Rima the Jungle Girl.
Stick that pin in your cap, guys, because we will come back to it.
Yes. So this set the stage for arguably the most ambitious superhero-themed cartoon up to that point in Saturday morning history, Challenge of the Super Friends, the next iteration of the series for 1978. Iwao Takamoto was the creative director, with Ray Patterson and Carl Urbano as principal directors, and the entire run of the series would be written by, sadly, Jeffrey Scott.
Can't we get away from him?
He's your buddy, James.
He's an arch nemesis. That's why we can't get away from him. We've got to keep this running gag going. Oh. I paid for that thunderclap sound.
How much did you pay for it?
Too much.
You could have just used Castle Thunder. I think that's free.
I was about to say, there's more than enough websites where you can get free sound effects. We didn't have to pay for it.
Yes, but this is the specific Jeffrey Scott thunderclap.
Jeffrey Scott is so bad, he has his own thunderclap?
Indeed, he does.
Wow, he hits supervillain status and he's not even a supervillain.
Just wait until we get to Muppet Babies.
DC Comics bigwigs Carmen Infantino, Julius Schwartz, and E. Nelson Bridwell served as consultants for the show.
Why couldn't they be writers and take it away from Jeffrey Scott?
And of course, some of Hoyt Curtin's brassiest, most outlandish-sounding music is scored for this series.
I actually really dig the music in this series. It's really jazzy.
It is.
Yeah, well, it's a superheroes cartoon.
The Super Friends theme sounds just really epic in general, to be honest.
It's a superheroes cartoon. You have to have it be epic. They're superheroes.
Yep.
Plus, it fits with the aesthetic of the animation of that opening.
Here's my hot take. The Super Friends theme is better than both the Justice League theme and the Justice League Unlimited theme. I'm throwing that out there.
I agree.
Yeah. So the first half hour of the show would be in a similar vein to the previous season's adventures featuring the Core Five plus the Wonder Twins and Gleek. But the second half hour would be a totally new run of episodes featuring a union of villains, first known as the League of Evil, eventually named the Legion of Doom.
Doom.
It's the second portion of the hour-long package that we'll be focusing on, since it is arguably the single most referenced and parodied iteration of the show, barring the original. The first portion will potentially get covered with some of the other Wonder Twins material from other seasons, much like how we covered Scrappy-Doo.
Oh boy. I don't understand why people have issues with the Wonder Twins. I have more issues with Wendy and Marvin.
I don't have issues
with the Wonder Twins either. It's just a lot of material, and a lot of it's kind of samey, so we don't really need to go season by season with them.
Fair enough.
Here's a note about the Wonder Twins I learned recently. They were created by Mo Howard's son-in-law.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm.
And they were going to be originally named Tarzan and Jane, but we're getting sidetracked. The initial creative thrust for this segment, as remembered by animator Daryl McNeil in an interview published somewhere online, you can track it down through Wikipedia, was to center around the newest recruit to the Super Friends, Captain Marvel, today better known as Shazam, thanks to legal wranglings far beyond the scope of this episode. And the League of Evil was to be led by one of his main foes, Dr. Savannah. Several villains were considered for this roster, including some that made it to the art phase in an Alex Toth illustration shared to our Instagram account earlier this week, featuring several villains who did not make the cut. And we have Dr. Savannah in the lead, with other Captain Marvel villains Mr. Atom, King Kull, and Beautia Savannah, the bad doctor's daughter, plus bat foes Joker, Penguin, and Poison Ivy, Flash enemies Captain Cold, Heatwave, Gorilla Grodd, and Abracadabra.
That's a deep cut.
And finally, Wonder Woman nemesis the Cheetah, and sworn enemy of all Green Lanterns, Sinestro. Mr. Freeze and Catwoman were considered at early points as well, but Hanna-Barbera could not use Captain Marvel or his enemies in animation. All those rights were tied up with Filmation.
It's always a rights issue, people. It always comes down to a rights issue.
And those rights would remain with Filmation for years to come, all the way up to Hero High.
Whew.
And there's still some rights issues with them clear for just back when they had his one appearance in Justice League Unlimited, because I think Bruce Timm mentioned they had to do a lot of like legal crap to get him to appear in one episode.
The Batman villain rights were also a tangled mess. Filmation had the rights to Catwoman, Mr. Freeze, Joker, and Penguin, not to mention Clayface. But Hanna-Barbera had scooped up Riddler and Scarecrow at minimum.
Two of my favorites.
Presumably, they had the rights for Poison Ivy, but opted not to use her, not to mention scrapping half of the Flash baddies originally planned for inclusion.
That just makes me really sad, because that would have been really cool to see Poison Ivy in a cartoon back in, like, the 70s.
I would love to see what her design would have been, because, I mean, she has evolved over the years since we saw her in animation in the 1990s. Like, she's really evolved in her design. I'd love to see what they would have seen, how they would have visioned her in the 1960s in animation.
Well, you can see her from the back in that illustration I mentioned earlier.
Yeah, it definitely goes for, like, the old school effect where she's got the, like, the leaf tiara, whatever you want to call it.
The circlet?
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So instead, the League of Evil, now renamed the Legion of Doom, would be led by Lex Luthor, and consist of the aforementioned Riddler, Scarecrow, Cheetah, Captain Cold, Grodd, and Sinestro, plus the additions of Giganta, the Toyman, Brainiac, Bizarro, Solomon Grundy, and the returning Black Manta from the previous season, based out of a swamp headquarters that looked suspiciously familiar. Right, Chrissy?
I think Extensive Enterprises has been selling the design for the Terror Domes, and I think that is how Cobra is making their money.
Actually, I was thinking another direction.
Oh, which one were you going? Oh, God! Someone get George Lucas on the phone. I think I really do believe he has himself a lawsuit.
It does look very suspiciously like Darth Vader's helmet.
It does! Like, it's not even a parody at this point. Like, at least Mel Brooks made it a parody. Like, dude, George Lucas, you have a lawsuit. Go. I don't know who you can sue at this point, but go for it.
Now, back to the Legion of Doom real quick. You can see a lot of one-for-one trades in this lineup, or two-for-one, two-for-two. You kind of get the idea. I mean, for instance, Mr. Atom was frequently depicted as positively gigantic, and presumably would have been a visual counterpart challenge to one of the original heroes created for the series, Apache Chief. When Mr. Atom couldn't be used, Giganta was added in his place. King Kull, a big old brute of a villain, a caveman with superhuman intellect and functionally immortal, had his spot visually handled by Solomon Grundy, while his intellect would be covered by Brainiac. Cheetah and the Captain Cold were natural replacements for Catwoman and Mr. Freeze, respectively. And it's also worth mentioning that the early planned inclusion of Mr. Atom could be what prevented the heroic lineup from including one of the heroes who guest starred last season, Ray Palmer, aka The Atom.
Because that would definitely cause some confusion.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
So before Legion of Doom, it was like, what was it called?
League of Evil.
League of Evil.
Legion of Doom sounds way better, I'm going to be honest.
I kind of agree with that.
Yeah, we're not the only ones who agreed, and we'll get into that in the postscript.
I also will say that the fact that they have been named Legion of Doom also, just as a kind of a side to this, it also led to one of the biggest jokes in our Sherlock Holmes society of the Legion of Zoom. Where if you have attended, I think it's 15 or more Zoom meetings from different science societies, you actually get this wallpaper to put behind you in Zoom meetings of all the villains from Sherlock Holmes.
Wow.
I have not gotten it yet, but it's pretty cool looking. So it's called the Legion of Zoom. So because of Legion of Doom, we now have the Legion of Zoom.
So who are our heroes? Well, aside from the core five and the aforementioned size-changing Apache chief, we also had The Flash, Barry Allen, Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, Hawkman, and two other original Hanna-Barbera creations. The electricity-based Black Vulcan, a stand-in for actual DC Comics character Black Lightning, when Tony Isabella wouldn't allow his character to be used in animation. And the wind-powered Samurai. The Wonder Twins were absent altogether from this part of the show, and other guests, Hawk Girl and Rima the Jungle Girl, didn't make the cut, leaving Wonder Woman the only woman representing the heroes altogether. The Smurfette principle in works, ladies and gentlemen.
They didn't even give her a Smurfette. It kind of stinks.
You mean a Sassette?
Sassette, you're right. I just got schooled on Smurfs by James. This is hilarious.
Wait a minute, does this mean that the Legion of Doom was far more female-friendly than the Hall of Justice?
Can yes. you believe that?
Surprisingly enough, if you actually follow Daniel Fox on Facebook, where he does his gay supervillain assistant comedy routine, he actually does a whole thing about how the supervillains tend to be more progressive because, you know, they want to keep their workers rather than just lose them all the time because good workers are hard to find.
Lex Luthor's like, I may be evil, but I believe in equal rights, just equally evil rights.
Exactly.
Well, the guy always makes sure to put the Joker in his team ups on the comics lately, so yeah, that tracks.
Just because he's crazy does not mean he does not deserve a paycheck.
Now, since the voice cast is so utterly massive, we're going to forego much of the usual voice actor roundup we do at this point in the podcast, and just quickly talk about them when they speak up in their episodes. Except for anyone who doesn't get a speaking part in them, which, as it turned out, was just one member of the Legion of Doom, the Toy Man, who is voiced by the omnipresent Frank Welker.
I mean, you got a Hanna-Barbera cartoon in the 70s. You bet Frank's going to be in it.
There's like two people. There's like two to three people you bet is going to be in a Hanna-Barbera cartoon. Frank Welker, Casey Kasem.
Don Messick. Yeah, if it's a like 60s era Hanna-Barbera cartoon, then you Don Messick and Dawes Butler is going to be in it. 70s era, Dawes started appearing less, but he still appears in several things. But yeah, it's definitely Don Messick, Casey Kasem, and Frank Welker. You've got a dang good chance they're going to appear, especially Don Messick and Frank Welker.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, there's just too much fun trivia to leave out, but we'd easily take half an hour just on them alone if we don't split it up. So on to our first episode, The Time Trap. My first thoughts as the episode begins: we should name these gators who appear in so many of the establishing shots at the Hall of Doom's secret swamp location. Them and Louise? Chauncey and Edgar? Hiroshi and Daisuke?
One of them is just Wally Gator getting a paycheck, let's be honest.
I vote that we name them Penny and Marshall.
All right.
Okay. So, a lot of these episodes will open with a member of the Legion of Doom complaining about their losing streak. In this one, it's Bizarro, who wants to go back to the Bizarro world where losing is winning. Wait, then why is he unhappy?
It's Bizarro. Are you trying to put logic to Bizarro?
Are you trying to put logic to Jeffrey Scott's writing?
That's a better question.
Get used to it, folks. We gotta ask these questions.
No, we don't. We just do it because we're crazy. Did you not state that in the beginning? We're lunatics.
Now, for that matter, shouldn't Bizarro be pleased with Luthor's threat that he'll be the one losing if he's not silent?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's like,
that's what I was thinking, too. I was like, shouldn't you be happy with yourself?
Right there, Lex.
Bizarro can be an odd fit at time in Super Friends, even when voiced by Bill Calloway, who also performs Aquaman for this show, as well as Square Bear, Clumsy Smurf, and as we've heard in past podcasts, as Howler and Frankie in Drac Pack.
Interesting note, in the very last season of the, I know this doesn't really relate to this, but in the very last season of Super Friends, they had Bizarro number one, who's actually voiced by this Danny Dark, I think his name's Danny Dark, the guy who voices Superman, which threw me off really bad when I was going through the series at one time.
But that kind of makes sense, because Bizarro is supposed to be a flipped version of Superman. So that makes more sense to me than totally different voice actor.
Luthor, meanwhile, is G. Stanley Jones, also known as Scourge on the Transformers, and Wordsworth and Riff Raff on Deke's Heathcliff cartoon, not to mention providing narration for the 1986 version of Little Shop of Horrors.
Little Shop of Horrors, Little Shop of Terror.
I did not know that Lex was Wordsworth this entire time. That's crazy.
I learned something new every time.
Lex's voice is really good in this. I'm going to say that. He does super villain really good.
Yeah, he does. I love how in this you have him, every time that you have Lex Luthor, it's Lexi. You type him as Lexi in your notes, and I love that.
Anyhow, it's Grodd's plan this time around, and his plan involves robbing Earth of historical treasures while preventing the Super Friends from stopping it via an interspatial time conveyor, basically a time travel device, opening doors to the past so the villains can steal stuff at their leisure. Oh, and Grodd's voice actor is Stanley Ralph Ross, who would take over Brainiac in the final seasons of the series, and also had writing credits on the live-action Batman and Wonder Woman shows.
I'm also going to throw in, I like Grodd's voice, too. It weirdly makes me think of an... It just sounds like an intelligent gorilla, I guess. I don't know. I just like it.
He really does a good job. It's like, you're going to play a very smart gorilla that's a genius and is probably the only one here that makes any sense. Go! And he's just like, got you. But I also love, like, I love it when the voice actors are more than just voice actors, like, when they do other things. Like, he's a writer, and he did stuff on the live Batman and Wonder Woman shows, and it's like, that's kind of cool that you did things outside of just being a voice actor.
Another hot take, I might actually like this Grodd voice better than Grodd's voice in Justice League. And I love Justice League, but I almost feel like Justice League Grodd sounded too overly intelligent, if that makes sense.
Yeah,
makes sense. I'm gonna agree to disagree on that one.
That's fair.
Now, transition! This is one of the show's most remembered aspects, those shooting stars that would signal switching from one location to another.
It's a really good transition. I mean, they did these a lot, especially in, like, 70s era cartoons and the 80s, but I literally think the one in the Super Friends is literally the best look. This star one is the best looking one. I've thrown that in random videos just because I think it just looks really neat.
It's also really good. It's also a nice way of just showing a nice clear cut. But it's also like, it's very comic book feeling to me too, if that makes sense.
Now at the Hall of Justice, Green Lantern, voiced by Michael Rye, who also performs Apache Chief, picks up a trouble alert, and Batman, Olin Sully, who has been voicing Batman since the Filmation cartoons in the 1960s, but has extensive live-action credits to his name, calls it on screen. It's a ship that's being raided by Black Manta, Ted Cassidy, Lurch himself, and also Brainiac for this show, and Giganta, Ruth Foreman in her lone reoccurring role. Aquaman and Apache Chief volunteer to take on the dastardly duo, and oh my freaking god! Apache Chief's halting English is outright embarrassing, even for the standards of the late 1970s.
Yeah, I have issues.
Imagine how I feel. I grew up in Oklahoma.
I was about to, like, I mean, you grew up in Oklahoma. I have friends who are Native American who would just, yeah, they would be flipping pissed.
I don't care how this guy dresses. He did not step right out of the 1800s. When Lassie's Rescue Rangers does something better than your show, something is very, very wrong.
Shit.
Can I throw
some shade right there.
Can I throw a vocal reference, another vocal role that was done by the voice actor for Green Lantern?
Sure.
He was the Lone Ranger in the, I think it was like late 60s, early 70s animated Lone Ranger cartoon.
Is that one on the list?
It should. It is now.
Okay.
It should. It's interesting. I like it, but it's, I don't know if I'd call it good, but I do like it. It's very interesting.
I've seen clips of it on some things, and it's one of those ones where I'm like, I kind of want to watch it, but I need like a reason to watch it type of thing.
Well, Crunchy and I did do commentary over two episodes of it, so.
Cool. I'm going to have to look those ones up now.
So the heroes are on the move, and the villains enact Evasion Plan 6. They clearly can't use Plan 9 since they're not in outer space.
Good one, James.
That was great. I love that.
It's all to plan as Grodd activates the episode's MacGuffin, sending the chase's participants back 70 million years. Apache Chief realizes it was time-related before spotting a water dinosaur. His exact words in that exact level of surprise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Water dinosaur.
Which I'm going to state, even if he did step out of the 1800s, they knew what the name of the dinosaur was in the 1800s. They knew the name of these things.
Did you know who probably didn't? Jeffrey Scott.
This is fair. But like,
and even setting that aside, he could have at least gone, a water dinosaur!
Oh my god! But, and even then, it wouldn't have been new, at least not that kind.
So with the dino diversion, Manta and Giganta head for their quarry as Aquaman tries communicating with the prehistoric fish in the area, and the narrator takes over the exposition. This is less egregious than when this would happen in the original Super Friends. I'll say that much. Because I remember a lot of scenes where Aquaman would go into the water and the narrator would exposit the whole thing.
I think someone explained to them that less is more.
Either that or just because comic books at the time had a lot of narration, that was because they're not animation.
That's fair.
But the lack of any animation on how the fish got him out leaves a little to be desired. Does this mean we add fish bites to things not allowed in 70s superhero cartoons?
Probably.
I guess so.
Although they might be in the next commission.
So the villains are robbing a South African diamond mine before it's discovered by humans. My first thought actually led me to learning something. Diamonds are not formed from coal. They were formed over 3 billion years ago. Point for the show in a way I didn't anticipate.
Yep, it takes between 1 to 3.3 billion years for diamonds to form, with constant pressure and heat exceeding temperatures that I will not pull out of my ass right now because I don't have my phone in front of me and I don't feel like pulling it up on withclarity.com, which tells you how to make diamonds. And they're not made from coal.
Yeah, I always thought they were made from coal, too. Where the heck did that ideal come from originally? Because I thought that, too.
Another story for another time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the A-Team, Aquaman and Apache Chief, tells their counterparts to put them back. And Giganta tries to start an avalanche, but Apache Chief matches size with size to fight back. This being the 1970s, they never get the chance to fight back. The villains escape back to the present day, trapping the heroes in the distant past.
James?
Yeah?
James? You just gave me the worst image. Since you called them the A-Team, I just had this image all of a sudden of Aquaman saying, I pity the fool who don't like...
I love it when a plan comes together.
Sadly accurate.
That is sadly very accurate.
Before we continue, I'm actually going to set aside any more complicated time travel thoughts from my analysis. That rabbit hole is too deep, and it's more effort than Jeffrey Scott deserves.
I'm only going to say one thing, and it's something that I learned from Star Trek Next Generation. Time travel sucks.
I'm going to throw something else out there for you. Be happy we're not watching the other time travel episode they did in this series, which is the Secret Origins of the Super Friends, where the Legion of Doom goes back in time to prevent certain Super Friends from existing. Boy, howdy, is that one going to make your head hurt if you ever watch it, because
I have it watched just that one.
Constantly contradicts itself.
Do you know that when you first told me we were watching the time trap, I honestly thought it was that episode because I didn't know the name of the episode. I just knew there was an episode where members of Legions of Doom went back in time to stop the Super Friends from becoming Super Friends. And then when I watched this, I was like, oh, it's this one.
They did time travel twice.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now at Mount Rushmore, Captain Cold, Dick Ryle's only animated credit, and Sinestro, Vic Perrin here, who voiced multiple Scooby-Doo monsters, as well as Filmation's version of Hawkman. It's worth noting Don Messick would take over Sinestro after this episode. They appear to be robbing Mount Rushmore of the face of George Washington. The Super Friends spot this too, with a holy stone carver's Batman from Robin, a.k.a. Casey Kasem. Like, zoinks!
Zoink, Scoob! I'm Robin!
I have to say, when I first heard Robin talk, I'm like, is that Shaggy? That sounds like Shaggy!
They actually got Casey Kasem to reprise his role as Robin for a bit that they did on Cartoon Network about, it was like a little one of those little shorts they did, except it was about sidekicks at a sidekick bar or something like that.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember that bit. That was back when Cartoon Network did some fun things and wasn't what it was now. When it was actually like Hanna-Barbera cartoons. Then it became Boomerang.
So Green Lantern and Samurai, who's voiced by Jack Angel, who performs triple duty on this show as Hawkman and Flash, and provided multiple voices on the Transformers.
He took over for Ultra Magnus.
Go, Jack Angel.
So they go to intercept, where they're greeted by Sinestro casually dropping Washington's head to just let it shatter. Yep, it's another ruse to send the hero sometime else. Specifically, Camelot?
Camelot?
It's just a model.
Yep, they're in King Arthur's days. And stakes are actually established here, as Hal's ring might run out of energy while they're displaced in time.
Granted, there is one major possible issue here. King Arthur may or may not have happened.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
It's seemingly possibly just a legend. Also, they technically, if legends are accurate, they technically wouldn't be in England, they'd be in Wales, but that's beside the point.
Back in the present, Batman and Robin are interrupted by a police alert, warning them of Grodd and Grundy. Jimmy Weldon, yes, the voice of Yakky Doodle, is Solomon Grundy here. Robbing the Gotham Treasury.
Didn't someone in one of the chats on Discord make a joke?
Mm-hmm.
Solomon Grundy want pants too!
Solomon Grundy lost his mommy.
Hey, I just want to say, I actually like Solomon Grundy's voice in this. For a long time, that was, for whatever reason, that's how I pictured Solomon Grundy sounding for a long period of my life.
It's like, actually, it's really good. And I think this was kind of, I agree. I always thought Solomon Grundy sounded, and I think every Solomon Grundy voice actor kind of based it a little bit off of this show.
I don't know, like, keep going back to Justice League. When Mark Hamill did Solomon Grundy in Justice League, I was kind of saddened that he didn't sound Southern. Because I don't know, something about Southern inarticulate third person talking zombie man just freaking works for me, and I love it.
Every animated incarnation of Grundy is very different, kind of like his own resurrections in the comics.
That's fair. That's true.
Anyhow. You can all see where this is going, with the device sending the dynamic duo to ancient Rome.
Wait, can I at least mention Solomon Grundy's wonderful line here? Mm-hmm. Where Batman's like, hold it, Grundy! Solomon Grundy not hold it! Solomon Grundy hold police car!
That was a good line. Oh, Solomon.
So Superman, who is voiced by advertising voice icon Danny Dark, and Wonder Woman, performed by Shannon Farnan, who also appeared on Valley of the Dinosaurs, they call the rest of the team to figure out what's taking everyone so long. Cold and Sinestro, back in the past, are robbing Arthur's riches, and the emerald-clad duo spot the exit point for the ill-gotten gold. This leads to the ring-slinging rivals to joust with constructs of horses and lances. This raises questions.
Especially how Hal grew a third arm in one scene.
Exactly. Also, the riches and that Arthur has, dude, like, Arthur didn't really have riches. Like, if anything, his riches would have been Excalibur and the search for the Holy Grail.
Now, my question, yellow is the Achilles tendon of Green Lanterns in general, and Hal cannot affect things of that color with his constructs. Why would Hal think it would work otherwise here?
Yeah. Because
this show forgets that a lot.
Yeah, it'll forget that in the next episode, too.
Yep.
Hey, I have nothing. It's Jeffrey Scott.
I really can't get over that scene, though, where Hal's like, if it's a joust you want, it's a joust you'll get. And he literally has three arms. They don't move. So I don't know how they drew three arms on Hal and no one caught that. That's a heck of an error.
And did you see, like, it hangs around for a little bit too? It's not like it was just that
the whole
one
scene. It's there the whole scene.
So the joust is a loss for Hal, and Sinestro is about to deal the defining blow at the commercial break. On the other side, Samurai says, "Kaze yo no ni hayaku," translating to swift as the wind, and becomes a tornado and stops the kill shot. Still, the villains escape just in time for the heroes to get blamed by Arthur's knights for theft, where they have to stew with Green Lantern's 24-hour charge depleted.
Dun, 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 dun.
You shouldn't charge that in the morning, Hal. Just saying.
You know, it's kind of like when your phone battery dies just when you have to make that important phone call.
Yeah, just charge it when you're asleep, man.
Like, seriously, you should be packing that stuff.
This is why Kyle is a better Green Lantern. Sorry, I had to throw that out there.
When in Rome, Grodd and Grundy plunder as the Romans do, stealing priceless statues and other loot before escaping Batman and Robin, and effectively the same thing that happened in Camelot happens to the dynamic duo. Batman says, "Grodd did a masterful job framing us." Did he? Really?
Okay.
You two absolutely nothing like them. Like, how?
I got two things to say here. One, what you just said. It's like, how do you mistake Big Zombie Man and Gorilla for Batman and Robin? But two, I got to mention that Adult Swim used this scene for something. There was a bit that Adult Swim used to do where they take scenes from old cartoons and add bleeps just to make it sound like they're swearing. And they actually did a bleep where when Batman says, "Grodd did a masterful job of framing us," they bleep on the frame that it actually literally sounds like exactly what you think it's going to sound like.
Oy vey.
Oy vey, indeed.
A very flamboyant performance by Stanley Jones as Caesar demands they be thrown to the lions.
I also would like to state, this is not Julius Caesar. Caesar, probably at this point in time, is a title. Because at this point in time, after Julius Caesar's reign, Caesar eventually became a title for emperor. So Caesar, at this point, is probably is the title.
Guys, I just got another really weird screen cap I'm going to send you of Wonder Woman.
Oh, no.
Oh, dear.
Oh, boy. I got to go find my phone.
I don't know what's going on with her hand here.
Is this going to go up on the Instagram so people can reference it? It should.
Oh, yeah. That will be... We should make that part of the YouTube thumbnail as well.
That and Hal with three arms.
What?
What is going on with her hand there, though? I mean, like...
She grew an extra finger!
Yeah! Because it's like, if that's supposed to be your index finger, then why is there four right next to it? And it's certainly not too big to be her thumb.
Well, you know, Amazon's keep, and she's missing clothes, by the way.
Well, it's just her upper half, so
either she's missing clothes or Superman got really tiny with his shoulder.
Fair point on both cases.
Yeah.
So the remaining super friends in the modern day are having no luck finding their compatriots as the Legion of Doom decide to go after Sutter's Mill next. And back in the most distant past, Aquaman and Apache Chief are standing on an animated element, which is naturally another dinosaur that they narrowly escape.
And somehow didn't notice they were standing on. I want to say, though, I love Grodd's delivery of just how joyful he is about stealing all the gold. I can't do it like he does, but it's so good.
I like how he thinks that they can get all the gold out of Sutter's Mill in a day. In a day.
At least some.
Oh, you act like that they're going to be nice enough to leave some. They're the Legion of Doom.
So Aquaman decides to go to the coordinates where the Hall of Justice will eventually be, reasoning that the battery in his communicator, being nuclear-powered, will last long enough to give off a signal at the time they disappeared. Folks, I try to limit myself to one now-wait-just-a-minute moment per podcast. There is a point in the second episode that is one of the mother of all of them. But this is sorely testing me.
I've got questions about just the nuclear battery in the first place. Wouldn't that be like radio freaking active?
I have so many questions. Like how is this safe?
Radioactive.
You're walking around with a nuclear powered mini device on your wrist. You're taking hits all the time. You're being shot at all the time. One of those missed shots can cause a nuclear disaster anywhere in the world. How is this sanitary and safe? Like, what's wrong with you people? You're supposed to be the good guys.
But of course, this works perfectly. Despite the confusion of the others, including the first and only time we hear Black Vulcan, voiced by Buster Jones, also known as Doc on G.I. Joe, and known for replacing Arsenio Hall as Winston in the real Ghostbusters.
He's also Blaster on Transformers.
Cool.
Superman spots the communicator via X-ray vision, and they have to get it carbon dated by an even bigger Japanese stereotype voice than Samurai's, and whoa! Massive animation error alert! Batman is at the Geological Center with them!
Yep.
Yep.
Speaking of which, the Asian stereotyped voice professor here is pretty much like it's Owen Sal, a.k.a. Batman's voice actor, doing a bad Asian accent.
Okay, I'm going to just tell you right now with this whole Batman thing, this is a theme, Batman being where he is not supposed to be.
Yep, we see that in the next episode too.
Hey. Uh-huh. He is a Jedi ghost.
You know why he does that? Because I'm Batman.
No, you're not.
I do want to say, as much as the nuclear battery thing doesn't make a lot of sense, this idea is almost clever. I will say that. Almost clever.
Almost. It's almost clever.
So Superman warps in time in a fashion far less impressive than he would in the first Richard Donner movie, to rescue Aquaman and Apache Chief.
Wait. Before you go into this, I gotta say something about this whole Superman going back in time thing.
Yeah.
Because the Flash literally is the one who says, well, that's why we can't find the other super friends. They're trapped in the past. And right after the Flash, I'm pointing out again, the freaking Flash says that. Superman responds with, yes, and with my super speed, I'll go back in time and find
them.
Thank you.
Doesn't he control the... He controls the speed force, which controls time. Isn't that supposed to be his whole thing?
Yeah, he uses super speed.
Least we forget, in the very first episode, when the Flash says, let's get him, when they're about to go into the final battle, he walks into the fight. The Flash walks.
I could also throw in that the Flash does use his time travel ability in the second time travel episode.
But my point is, I feel like Superman did that just to be a jerk. Because just to hog the glory. Because I imagine he did that, and right after he did that, the Flash was like, son of a mother pus bucket.
But part of me also sitting here too and being like, dude, there's two other groups that are missing. Get off your butt. You don't have to wait for him. You already know. You just tune into the communicator. You'll find them.
Well, at this point, they only know where one of them is. But yeah, regardless, later they could have done that. But yeah, I'm just like, I just imagine Flash is like, wait the freaking second here.
Exactly. Like, oh my God. This just proves to me Superman is secretly a jerk.
Okay.
So super jerk. Yeah.
Yes.
He uses the battery as a Geiger counter as he gathers up the rest, using it to detect the other communicators through the time barrier. As 1 minute, the dynamic duo lack their utility belts, and the next, they're back.
Not to mention, supposedly they're ignoring that animation error for a second. Let's just say that the fact that their utility belts were taken and then theoretically left in ancient Rome, could that cause a lot of problems with the time stream, theoretically?
Listen, yes, it's called a paradox. And no, we're not going to go there because it is not worth causing your brain to explode, because it will explode if you try to figure it out.
It's not a paradox. There's no doctors in the show. We need at least two for a paradox.
Well, we have Buster.
Okay,
we have Buster.
Need to call Matt Smith and Tom Baker, right?
Or David Tennant.
David Tennant, yeah.
Any one of the doctors will do.
I mean, we almost had Dr. Savannah.
That's almost. Fair.
I'm going to be honest, though. As cool as it would have been to have Shazam in this show and his villains, I kind of think Lex works better, especially considering Superman.
Yeah, I agree too.
Anyhow, the Super Friends compute through the crime computer the next place the Legion of Doom will be, which I suppose could be explained away, but wibbly wobbly, timey wimey, whatever.
Jeremy Bear me.
Green Lantern sends them back to Sutter's Mill. Now Green Lantern's doing the time travel stuff!
He said he could if his ring was charged. He said it back in Camelot that if his ring was charged, he could get him back home.
But they go to Sutter's Mill for the epic concluding battle as powerhouses like Grodd and Giganta are stopped by icicle cages and improvised log cabins. And Grundy is kept from grabbing Batman and Robin via Bat Lube.
Not only does Batman and Robin have Bat Lube, it goes down their legs.
I know, it's like dripping down their leg, and it's just...
What the F, Jeffrey Scott?
How did this not become a meme?
Because it's the next commission. I'm sorry, I'm dying.
What the heck?
You keep laughing, Chrissy. I'll take us to our conclusion.
Go for it. I'm sorry.
So, of course, Grodd and the rest escape via a time travel back door, and the Super Friends vow to pursue them anywhere they go.
Oh my God. I'm sorry, the Bat Loop killed me.
I got a question here. So,
yeah.
I see that there's some gold and stuff that got left there, but what about the diamonds? Was the diamonds in that truck randomly, or do the Legion of Doom still have those? And even if the Justice League got them back, like, what are they gonna do? Just lay them back where they were dug or something?
I would assume they would try to take them back in time and put them back where they found them, or otherwise you disrupt the time stream continuity thing, because then they're not there, and then you go and have the blood diamonds or any of that other stuff or the diamond trade or anything like that. I'm just going to say one thing, and I'm going to quote one of my favorite comics called Bob and George from the early 2000s. Time travel sucks, and I hate time travel.
I love time travel stories, but I would never write one because I'm going to get stuck in that loop and my brain will explode.
I tried to write one, and I literally had to walk away from it because I'm like, the amount of holes you have to try to spackle to stay away from the grandfather paradox, yeah, it's not worth it.
Now, believe it or not, folks, it's only going to get worse from here.
What?
Stay tuned as we have a funeral for the Super Friends. On our next podcast episode, it feels strange calling a show that ran for 243 episodes the humble beginnings in a creator's career. But when that creator is Akira Toriyama, and the following works included the Dragon Ball manga and anime, and the Dragon Quest and Chrono Trigger video games, Dr. Slump indeed becomes the humble beginnings. We reflect on a master and his origins in 2 weeks. You're watching the Super Friends on Boomerang from Cartoon Network. Our next episode is my pick for the most infamous episode of this season. Of Super Friends, anyway.
It is one of my favorites, I will say that.
What was it that I said to you on the chat when I after I watched this? What was it that I wrote to you? What did I ever do to hurt you? Something like that. I forgot what I wrote. Oh, whatever I did to piss you off, I'm sorry. I feel I've hurt you in some way to make you in some way for you to make me suffer like this. That's what I wrote.
The episode is Super Friends, Rest in Peace. Now, even compared to the dark, cold colors of starting at the Legion of Doom headquarters, this is a somber start to the show at a graveyard where the Super Friends are saying goodbye to Batman? Batman's dead? That's an attention grabber worthy of a Silver Age comic book cover.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Gotta say, you got my attention. Especially considering Batman's my favorite superhero.
I know. They kicked it off with the smartest one of the group.
Superman, Robin, Green Lantern, Hawkman, and Apache Chief are in the Batcave revisiting footage and tapping into the Hall of Doom archives. Whoa. We're not even a minute in, and this is testing my patience for BS. If they can tap into the Hall of Doom archives, what's stopping them from finding it and tearing the place apart piece by piece at any point?
Do I need to mention that in the last episode, their computer literally predicted what the Legion of Doom was going to do? So if they can do that, then why can the Legion of Doom even do crimes?
I feel that there's probably kind of a treaty or a contract between them where, in order for them to keep their jobs, they have to let them get away with some bullshit.
It would have raised far fewer questions if Mr. Scott wrote it that they were extrapolating satellite footage elsewhere.
Oh, you're giving him way too much credit.
Also, while I'm at it, can I point out Hal's speed racer level line he says in the cave?
Yeah, go for it, because it is like, definitely speed racer it's level. Like,
I'm ashamed, hiding in the Batcave like frightened mice in fear of our lives. It's like, yeah, frightened mice, you didn't need that rest of that after frightened mice, Hal.
We get it. Batman's dead and you're hiding. We got that.
It's like, redundant much.
And for the record, I am not giving Scott credit because the operative word of that sentence I said was, if. So it there.
Let's check that footage.
Yeah. Roll the footage.
The footage is of a few days ago where the Legion of Doom are drilling for something that's located 1 mile beneath the Hall of Justice, Noxium, an element used by Dr. Nataz, who was once part of the Legion of Doom, raising even more continuity questions, that Superman buried there. Once they reach it, they can't open it with a magna ray, and Sinestro theorizes it's cryptosteel, which only Supes can open. So Luthor resolves to trick the Man of Steel into opening it for them.
We also witnessed in this scene Sinestro's superpower we didn't know of, which is wearing a mask that somehow shoved his giant chin into it.
Yes.
So the whole Hall of Doom is deployed to open the Hall of Justice like a can of sardines, as Supes and Green Lantern move first to stop the assault. The latter constructs a mousetrap to slow the Hall of Doom down, and Superman barges in to find Luthor has disguised the box as a disintegrator ray. Not a very effective one, of course. And Superman responds with his heat vision, opening the box and revealing the Noxium. The footage ends with Black Manta gloating over Superman's retreat, and the quintet watching the footage, they observe that Noxium has everything loaded into it to destroy each member of the Justice League.
Can I just state that when I first saw Noxium written, I was thinking it was the Nexium, the pill that is used for GERDs.
Can I ask two questions after this? One, can't most of the Super Friends be taken out by a gun? And two, did the Legion of Doom just like decide to just leave after they scared Superman? Couldn't they have just attacked everybody in the Hall of Justice with that crystal?
Yes and yes. The answers to your questions are yes.
Now, I've also got a genuine question here, and this isn't me being an annoying jackalope over campy cartoon logic, for once. Were censors of the time that jumpy over violence that they wouldn't let either Grundy or Superman actually rip open the box? Much has been made over how the super strong characters in this show got wimpified by not being allowed to do much in the way of violence, but even this feels a little extreme. Or... am I looking at this the wrong way? And it was merely that the effects of the Magna Ray and Heat Vision were cheaper to animate.
It's probably that second one, but I'm going to just throw in that I'm always happy anytime I see Superman uses Heat Ray, even if it's backfiring on him.
I think it's more of the second one. It's probably cheaper to do the animation of the Magna Ray and the Heat Vision. Also, I think I can see Lex enjoying the irony of Superman contributing to his own downfall, too. That feels to me be more in Lex's character of let me trick them into giving me the key to their own demise.
So returning to the footage of the past, in Gotham City, Commissioner Gordon calls for Batman as Cheetah, Marlene Aragon's most prolific role, but she'd pop up as Elita One in Transformers. And Scarecrow, it's Ron Messick, Reggie! Basically have him hostage. Racing in the Batmobile, the Dark Knight detective is intercepted by the Riddler, Michael Bell, he of many voices over the course of the 70s and 80s.
He's almost rivaling Frank Welker for a number of voices, isn't he?
Yeah, my favorite of his is probably Lance from Voltron.
A quick car chase ensues that, by the low standards of 70s limited animation, isn't actually bad.
No, it's not.
And Batman thinks he has the Riddler cornered outside a movie theater, but Nygma has the Noxium. The irony of this occurring outside a movie theater, given Batman's origin, isn't lost on me.
You know what? Now that you pointed it out to me, I just realized that too.
I also want to throw out that the random person that witnesses this actually says Batman's dead, which, considering 70s censors, that it's kind of surprising because usually saying dead or killed is like a complete no-no back then. Actually, heck, they had problems with that clear in the 90s.
The only thing I could think of is if they ran this script by the censors first and be like, but they're not really dead and we're going to make that really clear later. Don't worry. Like, unless they did that.
I also have one other question, if you don't mind.
Okay.
Actually, two other questions. One, what happened to Commissioner Gordon?
Yes, that's a good question.
We never find out. Even though Riddler said that if you're trying to save your commissioner, you're too late. So did they kill Commissioner Gordon? Second of all, I love Batman. He's my favorite superhero and all, but you really didn't need the Noxium there. Like, you could have literally done that with a gun. I'm just saying.
Unless he's wearing a bulletproof vest or something, which I would not be surprised with Batman. But, yeah, what did happen to Commissioner Gordon?
Yeah!
What the hell? But I don't see Cheetah or... Well, Scarecrow, I can see... No, I don't even see Scarecrow. I don't know if they would have...
Scarecrow would be, like, tormenting the heck out of him.
I can see them torturing him. I can see that.
So the Legion of Doom are in a celebratory mood, and their next target is Wonder Woman. Their headquarters heads to Paradise Island, and the Amazons are helpless against the assault. Now, judging this by the standards of the time... Well, this is why I wish Calpedia were here. Exactly how badass were the DC Comics Amazons as a whole in the late 70s? They probably weren't up to battling Darkseid's army like they were in the recent DC movies, but for the sake of plot convenience for this cartoons, it seems they were still chickified into helpless damsels to at least some degree.
I also want to say that one of the Amazons is wearing some very un-Greek looking clothes. Like, it looks like she's wearing a swimsuit or something.
Yeah.
But it also could just be a factor of, you know, we got to make it look like they're in trouble for speed of plot.
Yeah.
And I mean, they're also being, they're not, it's not exactly.
Like I said, plot, sake of plot convenience for this cartoon.
Yeah. Also, they're being attacked. They're not, it's not like it's a land attack where people are actually invading. It's, they're being attacked from above.
Still, you'd think they'd have some kind of magical Greek mythology BS.
Pegasus. Maybe.
Maybe. Well, for sake of plot convenience, we're just going to say they didn't have it at that time, or it was, you know, Hestivus was fixing it that day.
Hippolyta calls for aid, and Wonder Woman is with the rest of the League in Aquaman's secret cove when that telepathic call goes out. And despite Aquaman's protests, she teleports away?
That's new.
Even so, Cheetah deals the lethal blow this time.
Like, well, then that makes sense, because that's her main foe.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I mean, because the other Wonder Woman character more or less gets made into Apache Chief's rival, so, yeah.
Back in the Batcave... Now, somehow, Perry White, editor of the Daily Planet and Superman's boss when the latter is in his civilian identity as Clark Kent, is able to just contact the Super Friends at his leisure? There's cartoon campiness, and then there's this!
Furthermore, aren't they in the Batcave? Why does Perry White know how to contact Batman?
I don't know. Maybe there's just like one red line. Maybe there's just one direct red line to the Super Friends, and it just happens to route to everyone. Who says it's just directly to the Batcave? Maybe it's ringing in all their houses.
Maybe Superman has his own channel that he uploaded to the Bat computer.
You know, it's kind of like a four-way call.
It's a Zoom meeting.
Group meeting. It's a Zoom call. It's a Zoom call. The Legion of Zoom.
Regardless, the Doomers have Lois Lane, which is all Superman needs to hear to come flying to Metropolis, where Perry and Lois are held hostage in Clark's office. And Superman, knowing how deadly this is, just walks through the door.
Superman needs to slow his roll. Dude, we know you love her, and we know you want to get with her, but dude, your life's on the line.
I'm more questioning why they picked Clark Kent's office for this, other than... poetic justice. Does Lex and Solomon Grundy know Superman's identity, or was it just a lucky coincidence?
Or it was the only office where no one was in at that time. It was like, it's an empty office, let's go here.
After the break, at least Superman is trying to dodge the ray, and is only grazed enough for the Noxium to sap his strength. He leads the planet staffers to the printing room, and he traps Grundy in one of the printing presses. You know, this isn't a bad gag, seeing the massive lug come out of the press all bundled with finished papers, but it butts up against the matter of Grundy's own strength, so right gag, wrong genre.
I will say, though, I have seen those printing presses. in person when I did do a tour of the local paper up here, those suckers are huge. I could see it happening.
Yeah. And I think it's one of those cases where it's a good enough gag that I can hand wave it.
Yeah, I can. I could too. And it works for Grand. I mean, if it was like any other Legion of Doomer, I would probably be not quite as but not quite as forgiving. But if it was, but it's Grundy, like Grundy and Bizarro, I can let it go with because that's the kind of characters they are. They can do it. If it was anyone else, I'd be like, no.
No, my problem is them not getting out.
Yeah.
Yeah, then, okay, that part I have an issue with. Well, Grundy's not exactly the fastest on the uptake.
Maybe he's just confused.
That could be it, too. He could just be confused, like, what the hell's this?
We see Superman continue to put up a struggle against the Noxium Ray, but to no avail. Superman is dead. Cue 6 issues of Funeral, 6 issues each series of Replacement Superman. Sorry,
that's the 90s. We're not there yet.
Funny thing, they actually have a Death of Superman episode in the final season of Super Friends. So go figure.
They just keep trying to kill Super Jerk off, don't they?
The rest of the Super Friends retreat to a Marine base. And yet again, Batman is part of an animation error.
He's a Jedi ghost at this point. I swear.
It's almost a drinking game at this point.
I'm Batman. I can be wherever I want, even when I'm dead.
I'm Batman.
The Super Friends are there to receive Superman's body. But the Legion of Doom radio them to give them an ultimatum. Vacate the Earth within 24 hours or share the fate of the Trinity.
And Hal Jordan takes off all his clothes for one scene.
Yes, he does, which raises a lot of questions. Like, Hal, why are you getting naked at this time? Time and place, dude. Time and place.
Black Manta decides to share the bad news to the rest of the world, declaring that, well, let him speak for himself.
Now that the Earth is no longer protected by the Super Friends, the Legion of Doom will be taking over. All military and police forces throughout the world report to us directly. All governing bodies of the United Nations shall be under our supreme command. The Legion of Doom will control all of planet Earth. Or should I say, the planet of Doom.
There's little the Super Friends can do, so they fly off planet. The Flash flies.
All the Super Friends are getting weird powers in this episode. Wonder Woman teleports, Flash flies. I don't know how Robin gets off the planet.
They showed the bat jet.
Okay.
So seemingly the bat jet can fly in space. Well, it does in some other episodes, yeah. So, yeah.
Fair enough.
In no time flat, the Legion of Doom's takeover is so thorough, they have the police doing robberies for them. Oof. And Riddler and Brainiac manipulate the world's credit to further enrich the Legion. Next thing you know, a quartet of them are about to take over the World Microwave Communications Center in Colorado when the remaining Super Friends stage an ambush there. Sinestro conjures bagpipes to blast them down, but Green Lantern bats it away. Again with the inconsistency on when he can and cannot affect Yellow! Black Vulcan stuns the others, but Luthor jet boots in, at least his flight is explained, and starts dispatching the heroes in short order. More gloating, and Luthor tosses the Noxium down a sewer grate?
Okay. Why would you get rid of the one thing that helped you keep power?
Why? Because they're all dead.
But you, listen, even he knows by now. You don't know. I don't care. You know someone else is going to try to rise up. That's probably another superhero. And is going to try to take you out because it always happens. You don't get rid of the thing that gives you power.
And on top of that, Luthor is such an egomaniac. Wouldn't he want to put that in a museum surrounded by statues of himself?
Thank you.
You'd think so.
It's a trophy at this point.
But, you know, convenience and plot. And have we plot mentioned this was written by Jeffrey Scott?
Plot convenience.
Now, a bit later, A figure in a hazmat suit finds an oxium and just shoots it into space with a bazooka.
It's a hell of a bazooka.
I know, seriously.
A grim but familiar voice just says, "It's done." The next day, the Legion of Doom are extorting the various world leaders when a delegation comes in and claims to represent every nation. And that's Superman's voice, of course. The League is alive, and after a particularly weird action sequence that sees Lex Luthor get trapped in a dollar bill by Green Lantern.
The Riddler and Batman using magic on each other.
I know, yeah. Like, when the hell did the Riddler be able to cast magic? Like, no.
They really wanted to use Abracadabra, didn't they?
I think they did.
Actually, that's not even the weirdest thing. The weirdest thing is Batman uses a boomerang. Not a batarang.
A boomerang. It wasn't even a batarang. It was a boomerang. And it's like, oh my lord. Like, did you not forget what you were doing, animators? Did you forget?
In the end, it's revealed that what Luthor killed were the Super Friends robot duplicates who were programmed to fail.
I actually like Cheetah's line about, "I'm going to stop you, Wonder Woman, and the whole world will help me," as she throws a giant globe. I thought that was really cute. Okay.
She's got the whole wide world in her hand. She's got the whole wide world in her hands. Okay.
Everyone in the car. Everyone in the car. Come on. All right. Okay. We resume our podcast here at Echo Point. There's nothing but wide open space surrounding us. Massive canyon. Because it is the only place I can appropriately say, "No way does not matter!"
Can we have this in every time you need to do a "Wait Just a Minute"? Because this was actually really therapeutic.
You gotta be kidding me! Robot duplicates! You've just removed any sense of stakes from any episode going forward now with this precedent.
Good thing it's only one more episode.
Do I need to mention that how also this is really dickish because Lois Lane, Perry White, and possibly a dead Commissioner Gordon's lives were put in the hands of robot duplicates.
Not to mention the entirety of Paradise Island.
Exactly.
Put in the hands of robotic duplicates made to fail.
Exactly. Like, your loved ones mourned you. You were killed in front of them. You dashed people's hopes and dreams. You put nations' lives on the line, their credit on the line. Economies crashed. For what? For what?
For you guys to just sit and chill in your freaking satellites or wherever you were hiding.
I understand. They had an oxium. You guys should have gotten rid of that shit a long time ago when you knew what it was capable of. Not buried underneath the Doll of Justice where someone could get it. That stuff should have been yeeted into space a long time ago.
I love that you used yeet.
So, with that out of my system, I come to a sobering realization. Was this maybe as good as a show like this could have been in the 1970s, given the environment and the zealotry of network censors and media watchdogs of the era towards superhero violence? I mean, it would take a deft, massively skilled writer to juggle 24 regular characters and their various powers and weaknesses to reach even an average level of quality. Jeffrey Scott is not that writer. We've established that with his 1980s work over the course of several of our 2023 podcasts. And this is him at an even less experienced point in his career. But
that's fair.
But consider DC Comics had not one, not two, but three consultants, including Julius frickin' Schwartz, looking over this series. Either they weren't looking terribly hard, which is my guess, Or, to quote the Mystery Science Theater 3000 episode, Attack of the Eye Creatures, keep circulating the tapes, they just didn't care.
Probably that one, sadly.
Well, here's my also question, too. Are the three consultants that they had, were they just working on this cartoon, or were they still working their full-time jobs at DC as well?
It's a good question. And you know what's even more sobering? This is still leagues better than the original 1973 series.
Yeah.
Now, the Legion of Doom is one of the longest-lasting legacies of the Super Friends franchise. Cartoon Network got a lot of mileage out of them for ad bumpers and promo spots. Solomon Grundy want pants too! Was a meme before memes were codified.
That's very true.
And a truly massive version of the Legion of Doom, featuring some great power struggles plays between Grodd and Lex Luthor, was the focal point of the final season of Justice League Unlimited on Cartoon Network as well. And in the comics, the Legion of Doom would be revived in a more serious form under the ink and pen of the notoriously Silver Age-obsessed and admitted Super Friends fan Alex Ross in an out-of-comics continuity storyline.
Interesting you should mention that. In the original Challenge of the Super Friends DVD box set, they actually had two episodes as commentary with Alex Ross.
Makes sense.
And Jeff Johns.
Also makes sense.
That's fair.
Although several groups in the comics would resemble the Legion of Doom concept both before and after the Super Friends team up, another expanded version of the Legion of Doom with that name would enter DC Comics continuity in 2018 as written by Scott Snyder. And on top of that, the wrestling fan in me insists on briefly mentioning the other Legion of Doom, which was more than just Hawk, Animal, and manager Paul Ellering. In Georgia Championship Wrestling, it would include a rotating roster of wrestling luminaries like Jake Roberts, the Iron Sheik, the Spoiler, King Kong Bundy, and Arn Anderson, all under Ellering's management. Once that group faded into history as people went their separate ways into other promotions, a Legion of Doom name would be used with that tag team it's most famously associated with, Hawk and Animal, interchangeably with their other name, the Road Warriors.
I remember that.
And as for the Super Friends cartoon itself, it would continue on ABC for a good while. And those are, of course, stories for future podcast episodes. But as far as connections to this specific season goes, a good chunk of the villains would reoccur here and there within the series, notably Grodd, Lex Luthor, Brainiac, and Bizarro. And the Legion itself would reunite, though without most of their voices, in the 1983 episode, Revenge of Doom.
Doom. Not to be confused with the movie Dune.
There's even an episode later where the Legion of Doom gets at least name-dropped, where Superman accidentally goes back in time and prevents Krypton from being destroyed, only to go to the future and find that the Legion of Doom has taken over the world.
Oh. Well, dude, he weren't there to stop it.
Yeah, it was in one of the future seasons, which was kind of, I was just surprised they even mentioned the Legion of Doom at that point, but I was like, oh, nice. But I gotta say something about the Super Friends.
Yeah.
For better or for worse, this was my first introduction to pretty much all of these characters when I was really young. Like, this is the first time I ever saw Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, The Flash. I mean, and even later, for a long time, until I really got into comics, this was the only... I wouldn't have even known who Captain Cold was if it wasn't for this show.
And it took me to actually get you to see what Captain Cold could really be capable of.
Which I will thank you for, because now I know he is awesome. He is definitely up there in my favorite... DC villains. I like him and Grodd a lot. Actually, I'm willing to say that I think The Flash has the second best rogues gallery, in my personal opinion.
You will find no argument from me.
Yeah. I
I will get an argument from Kylepedia on that, and he's also a big Flash fan, but he actually will, he feels that the Flash is the third best because he disagrees with me on the best.
So who is the best to you?
To me, it's the Batman Rogues Gallery is the best.
I agree. I like the Batman's Rogues Gallery because it's very diverse.
I think I'm with Kyle because I suspect he thinks it's the Spider-Man villains.
You're exactly right.
Well, I see, I can't compare Marvel and DC to each other because they are two different tones to me. So I have to take them separately. For Marvel, it's definitely the Spider-Man Rogues Gallery is number one for my Marvel comics. And it's Batman for my DC comics. I have to take them separately because they have two different tones to me.
I can mix them. And sorry, I know it might be a... It might be a take that a lot of people won't like, but Batman's number one for me, then Flash, then Spider-Man. So,
well, it's all subjective.
It is. I mean,
at least we all are favoring the same three.
Exactly.
Even if they're not in the same order.
See, to me, this cartoon was not my first introduction to a great deal of these characters because I actually grew up, I actually ended up watching, believe it or not, it was this Superman cartoon that was based off of the George Reeves Superman. And then I also grew up.
Spears one?
What's that? Which it was? No, it was. I think it's even older than that.
The Filmation.
Oh, the Filmation one.
Yeah.
From like the 60s or.
I think it was like. It's got. I think it's the 60s or something.
Yeah.
And then there was, then I also used to watch the Batman 66.
Yeah.
So then I would watch this. So I got introduced to obviously the Flash and all the other ones too. But like Wonder Woman, I used to watch Linda Carter play Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this was not my first introduction to the DC comic universe. Plus I also would steal my cousin David's DC comics when he was done with them too. So, sorry, Dave.
Well, it's just whenever, like, I have, when I think of, like, the earliest memories I have of watching cartoons on TV, other than theatrical stuff like Looney Tunes, Tom and Jerry, I remember watching this, the earliest memories that pop in my head is, like, the Flintstones, Scooby-Doo, and the Super Friends. So.
Yeah, mine has always been Looney Tunes, Flintstones, Jetsons, Smurfs. And then I would watch other stuff too, but. I mean, this isn't bad. I mean, honestly, like, this isn't the worst I've seen for superhero cartoons. It's enjoyable. It's just has a lot of stuff to it. It's definitely a Jeffrey Scott cartoon.
It's like I said at the top, I love and hate this cartoon at the same time.
I would much rather watch this than Hulk Hogan's Rockin' Wrestling again.
Yeah. And despite what I said, this still very much beats out Lassie's Rescue Rangers.
Lassie's Rescue Rangers only just did one part better than it. Which is still some major shade, though.
I also want to just for the heck of it, I want to give some credit to Olin Sal as Batman, because he's one of those Batman actors you don't really hear people credit much. I think he actually does a great job for that style of Batman.
I think he did, too. He did. I actually liked his voice as Batman. I actually want to now see more stuff he's in because I kind of enjoyed him in this.
Yeah, he's also in the Scooby-Doo crossover.
That's what I was thinking was when he did. I was about to ask. Did he voice Batman when they crossed over into Scooby-Doo?
Yeah, it's him and Casey Kasem in that too. They started with the Filmation series and kept it up until like the last season of the Super Friends when they decided to replace Olin Sal with Adam West, which, you know.
Yeah, if you know, you know.
But, it's like, sure, Olin Sal's not no Kevin Conroy, and he's no Adam West, but I still like him for this style of Batman. I still think it's a really good voice, and I think it works really well.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts before we wrap up?
I was just also going to say, if you ever watch those old Filmation Batman cartoons that has Olin Sal and Casey Kasem as Batman and Robin in those as well, they sound way better in their acting is way better in this and that Scooby-Doo crossover than it is in the Filmation cartoon. They sound
their acting is really wooden in the Filmation ones, and I think that's because some of the old Filmations has a terrible history of having bad voice direction, and it shows. But other than that, I love this show. I actually absolutely love this show. It's dumb. It makes no sense. It's campy as all get out. But I love this show. And this is like my favorite season of the show because it's great. It's insane. But I love it. And I wouldn't know half of these characters if it wasn't for this show.
And you know what? Sometimes with shows, they don't have to be the smartest. They don't have to be the best. You just have to be able to shut off your voice, shut off your brain, and just enjoy them.
Well, there really isn't a superhero cereal on the market right now, is there?
Nope, but I could probably make a superhero-themed cupcake cookies.
Ooh, that'll work. Good night, everybody.
Bye, everyone. See ya.
The Penny and James can sort of hopefully funny cartoon. Podcast.
The preceding podcast is a co-production of the Mighty Monkey Corporation and Artificial Orange Studios. The theme song is written, composed, and performed by Sean Michael Smith. For questions and comments, email me at james@fc3roc.org.